Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
$28 billion is not actually very much these days.
Find it down the back of the sofa.
Welcome to The Power Test. I'm Aisha Hazarika.
And I'm Sam Friedman.
So Sam, today we're going to really dig into the nuts and bolts of how the Treasury works, but also how an incoming Labour team at the Treasury kind of navigates all these really difficult issues. And we're going to dig into the growth question as well, because I feel that we hear politicians talking about growth all the time, but we don't really dig into how you get growth. We hear a lot about councils and about strategies and about bringing the great and the good together. And we just want growth more than the other guys. Mm. And we're going to sort of try and dig into that a bit today with a real expert.
Yeah. You know, we've got Nick McPherson, who's been at the Treasury for a very long time. He was at the Treasury for a very long time, right the way through from the Thatcher years through to the Brexit referendum. And many of the people who are there now and will be working with Rachel Reeves when she arrives are people that he essentially trained, came through under his leadership. So couldn't ask for a better guest to get into this sort of question of what exactly will that transition be like? What will Labour need to be thinking about when they arrive? And as you say, what are the sort of growth levers that the Treasury believe can be pulled? Because it's all very well to sort of throw around, you know, productivity, planning, sort of all these words. What are the detailed things that actually need to be done? How long will they take? Because that's the other thing. Even if you're serious about doing some of these things, just the amount of time that they'll take to get done.
And I think one of the things that I'm really keen to hear from Nick McPherson is a question that, you know, we go round and around a lot, which is Labour boxing themselves in too much at this stage, you know, or will they inevitably, once they get in, say, actually, we are going to have to borrow to invest a bit more? I think that's something that I'm quite keen to get into with him.
Yeah. And sort of wider questions around sort of fiscal rules and how the kind of whole framework is working. Because I think, you know, Nick is his hashtag on Twitter that he uses all the time is sound money. You know, he's got that sort of very traditional Treasury belief in very sustainable finances. But, you know, at the same time, he is, as we all are, well aware of the huge public services challenges that are facing the country and all of the pressures that are coming from an ageing population and so on. So it'll be interesting to see how he thinks Labour should manage that tension. So Nick, great to have you with us. And I wanted to start by asking about that sort of process of transition, how you experienced it in 97 and in 2010, and what advice you'd be giving to the current permanent secretary at the Treasury as to how to handle a potential new government coming in later this year.
Funny enough, in 2010, I spent a lot of time considering the history of transitions, because there haven't been very many in the last few decades. And I spent a bit of time looking at 1979, when the Treasury really found it very difficult to adapt to the policy agenda of the incoming government. The then Permanent Secretary had made a speech attacking monetarism in late 1978. This hadn't gone down very well with Mrs. Thatcher. So there was a sort of policy disconnect in 79. In 97, I was there firsthand, and we did an awful lot on the policy agenda, but we hadn't really thought through how a very close-knit group of people who'd worked very successfully in opposition would want to work. The fact was Tony Blair and Gordon Brown had never been ministers, and they had a well-developed style of working. And again, I think the Treasury found that difficult. So in 2010, I really tried to ensure that we not only understood the policy, but we also spent some time thinking about how we would appear to an incoming government and really try and understand where the likes of George Osborne would be coming from. Because getting trust early on is not terribly easy. Understandably, politicians tend to think that the permanent side of government is, in the end, sort of stooges of the previous government and therefore can't quite be trusted. And it takes a bit of time to, you know, establish the sorts of relationships which can work well.
I think it's sort of a matter of public record now that in 2010, George Osborne was very sceptical of you as leader of the Treasury and, you know, had been thinking about putting somebody else in place. And you managed to sort of convince him that you were not a stooge of the previous government. So what was that process of working with a new chancellor, you know, both before the election and the access talks that Labour will be currently having now, and then after the election, in sort of building that trust?
I had quite a lot of meetings with George Osborne ahead of the 2010 election. I think we had something like six formal sessions just going through their agenda for the organisation of government, because actually the sort of constitutional precedents quite rightly actually limit the scope of those discussions to issues around machinery of government and so on. I'd also met him a mutual friend had introduced us and invited us both to dinner. So I had a couple of dinners with him in the year before the election. I mean, needless to say, I thought I'd developed a good relationship, but you never know with these things. And I think he was less interested per se in getting rid of me, but more interested in bringing in somebody else who he had his eyes on as a trophy appointment. I think what happened was that first, I think the Treasury delivered for him. He wanted £6 billion of in-year spending cuts to announce within, I think, 10 days of coming into office.
2 weeks. I remember having to find them from the Department for Education. That was my job.
You're lucky, Matt. I mean, it was a classic Treasury cuts-driven exercise, but actually we did it quite well. I mean, he told me about a week before the election was called that this was his plan and could we get on with it. So I think that was quite useful. I think another factor, my old friend, the late Alistair Darling, actually had dinner with him and said he'd be really stupid to get rid of me. At least that's what Alistair said. And it sounds actually very plausible because...
The sort of thing he would have done, yeah.
Just the sort of thing he would have done. And I think he also said that the Treasury wouldn't take kindly to the alternative. I stayed and actually we ended up getting on really quite well, and I would regard George Osborne as a friend.
Nick, it was interesting seeing the approach. I mean, George Osborne took one approach. Famously, Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng took a very different approach when Kwasi Kwarteng came into the Treasury in 2022 and, of course, removed Tom Scholar from his position and mayhem ensued. When you look back at that moment, what did you think at the time?
Well, I thought it was a slightly strange way of carrying on. I mean, just to be clear, if the Secretary of State and their permanent secretary don't get on, there's only one person who's going to go. It's the permanent secretary. And that's fine. I mean, actually, if George Osborne had decided he didn't want to work with me, you know, I'd have been a bit disappointed, but I'd have moved on and so on. Normally, a sensible political handling of a situation like that would be to leave the individual in place, but kind of agree a timescale by which he or she would go, or move them sideways. I mean, that's what happened in 79. The then Permanent Secretary, Sir Douglas Wass, actually had to wait about a day after the election. He told me, he's now dead, sadly, before Geoffrey Howe got in touch with him. Such was the uncertainty about whether he would continue in post. But then Margaret Thatcher, in a rather skillful move, made him joint head of the civil service. So although he was still formally Permanent Secretary of the Treasury, that role in relation to the civil service kind of took him out of the mainstream of discussion. So I think the Liz Truss move was really quite unusual. I mean, I don't think it mattered in and of itself. It was the combination of doing that, ignoring the OBR, ignoring the markets, and then when the mini budget got a bad reception, going out and saying, we're going to do more of this. The cumulative effect was quite substantial. And the great irony, and I felt this quite passionately at the time, and obviously I'm biased, I know Tom very well, and he's a friend, is the one guy in the Treasury in 2022 who really knew how to handle crises, because he'd done all the bank recapitalization for Alistair Darling in 2008, was Tom Scholar. Mm. He had great connections internationally, understood the IMF and so on. It was just a move of extraordinary amateurness, dressed up as the smack of firm government.
But it doesn't feel like Rachel Reeves is the sort of person who's going to come in and do anything like that. You'd think she'd keep senior people in post initially, you know, and if she did want to make changes, would do it in a sort of, in that more sort of smooth way over time. But I guess the question is what will she do to try and get across her agenda and her way of doing things differently? And, you know, from what you've seen of how the Treasury operates, how are they trying to assess what that is and try and support that? And are there areas where you think there might be some tensions between what she's sort of talking about and the traditional Treasury view, or sort of the Treasury view at the moment?
I would have thought that there would be many problems. The Treasury is obliged, like any civil service department, really to seek to understand Rachel Reeves' agenda. It's also got to be prepared for any election result. Certainly what I did in the year before the last election is forget about the politics. What are the fundamental structural challenges facing the British economy, the public finances, and so on? And then to be pretty much ready for anything. As it happens, you know, I did read the May's lecture in preparation for this discussion. I think a lot of this actually chimes with what most people in the Treasury would be advising. I mean, first, you know, a serious focus on growth. I mean, to be fair, Mr. Hunt is also focused on growth, but I think Rachel Reeves is clearly wanting to embed a framework which will last, and is very much talking about a plan which could potentially be played out over a 10-year period. I think that will be music to the Treasury's ears, because in one sense, we kind of understand the sorts of drivers of growth. But the problem in the last few years has just been these extraordinary political changes, which just mean that the government is endlessly relaunching itself. And so you never get the focus you need on delivering growth. You get lots of fine policy statements, but a lot of the underpinning policies to make it happen is quite boring and tedious and requires relentless focus, both on the part of the elected government, but also the civil service. And the problem we've had over the last 6 or 7 years has just been endless to and froing, and which just mean that there's been very little practical focus. As for the sort of macroeconomic policy, my guess is Labour will, and so they should, borrow a bit more in order to invest. And providing that investment programme is focused on what really matters and is then seen through, I don't see that as a great problem in terms of the public finances. Indeed, some would argue that Labour may be being too cautious. Mm. I know it's going to be a different government. I know she wants to define herself as being different from New Labour. But anybody who was around under the Labour government between 1997 and 2010, and actually I think most of the senior leadership of the Treasury were, and indeed just as they've worked for David Cameron and George Osborne and Rishi Sunak, a lot of the senior people worked for a long time for Gordon Brown. So I think this could be a relatively easy transition.
And Nick, I think you've said something really interesting there about, in your view, that Labour should and probably will end up borrowing a bit more to invest, and you don't see that as a huge problem. I mean, that's the question that so many people are pondering at the moment. Many people who do want a change of government, they want to see Britain going in a different direction. But Rachel Reeves is hanging quite tough on that at the moment and saying, actually, I'm not going to do that. I've set out my fiscal rules. That message has been reinforced across the shadow cabinet. How do you think politically she and Keir Starmer will navigate that? Do you think they're boxing themselves into a corner by saying again and again, we're not going to come in and borrow more to invest?
This is a difficult one. I think the case for being tough now, potentially it gives them room for manoeuvre. It gets them credit with the financial markets, which actually is even more important today than it was in 1997, simply because the national debt is a whole lot higher. The interest rate bill required to service that debt is very high indeed. So you really don't want long-term interest rates to be going up, because that will squeeze out spending, which you want to make on your priorities. So I can understand why they're doing what they're doing. I suspect it may already be affecting the markets. I think one reason why sterling at the moment is reasonably stable and interest rates are coming down is the markets quite like the idea of a bit of stability. And Starmer and Reeves, in a sense, represent stability compared to a political party which day in, day out, someone's either resigning or denouncing the leadership. The other thing is, and this may surprise some people, is I'm a relative optimist about the economy. I think the Labour inheritance may just be a little bit better than the OBR and others are suggesting, simply because real wages are rising. Interest rates may come down this year, which will help people with mortgages and so on. And we just may see more spending in the economy growing a bit more fast, and rather more revenues coming in than expected. So if I'm right, I'm not always right, I can assure you, they may actually have rather more room for manoeuvre. Mm. And so they may be able to stick with the fiscal plan whilst also spending a bit more. My guess is also they will have some tax increases up their sleeve of the sort, which is consistent with the wider commitments not to raise the main rate, say, of national insurance and income tax. I mean, did they have to drop the $28 billion commitment? I don't think in the end, $28 billion is not actually very much these days. It's less.
Find it down the back of the sofa.
It's about 1% of GDP. I mean, compared to the sorts of money Nigel Lawson gave away in 1988, this is chicken feed. Mm. But I can see in an uncertain world why they just want to be a bit cautious. If I was still at the Treasury, I'd be trying to get across, because I'd try to say this to most chancellors, don't get too obsessed with fiscal rules. The only people in the end who seem to care about fiscal rules are the Treasury. No one else really believes them. What matters is the substance. Mm. Do you have a plan? Mm. Do you have credible projections for spending and taxation, which will in the end result in the deficit broadly coming down? Those are the things which matter. No one gives a toss about some weird rule which is about what's going to be happening to debt in 5 years' time, which you can always revise away each year because the fifth year is always rolling forward.
And you can always gain by pretending you're going to spend less money than you actually are.
Yeah.
I'm glad you said that, because I think this is such a fundamental... You know, we've sort of got into an annoying dichotomy on fiscal rules where it's either if you support them, you're sort of pro sort of fiscal sustainability, and if you're sort of against them, you want to spend loads of money. Whereas actually the point is, it's the obsession with the rule itself rather than the purpose of the rule.
Yeah, the rules always end up making you do stupid things.
Yeah.
So my advice to any minister is, look, focus on the substance. Don't rush into new rules. The Tories have changed them every other year. And the world never falls in quite, apart from in the Truss era.
Yeah, when that was very different, because they really...
They did test fiscal sustainability to destruction. But actually, that's quite helpful for the Treasury, because when I joined the Treasury in the early 80s, people were still going on about the IMF in 1976. And actually, that affected the public finance debate for a good 20 years. Mm. I do think the Truss Kwarteng disaster will live on and strengthen the Treasury's hand for the next 20 years.
I'm Flo.
And I'm John.
And if this episode has got you thinking and you've got your own thoughts, reflections and ideas to share, then come and join us and other members of the PowerTest community for The Debrief.
Each week, The Debrief is your chance to discuss everything about this week's pod, dissect the key takeaways and look at where we go next.
We're live every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Spaces over at The Power Test on Twitter.
So come and join us, and together, let's talk more about how we can change Britain for the better.
Make sure you're subscribed to get a reminder and all the latest from the team and much more.
Nick, I just want to return to something you said earlier, because you're right, both Jeremy Hunt and Rachel Reeves are very much focused on the pursuit of growth. Everybody is growth is the thing that everybody wants to get. Now, you said at the beginning of our chat that we kind of know what the kind of levers are to get growth. Can you just explain briefly to our listeners, in your view, what are the kind of ingredients to get growth? Because that's the thing that I think many of our listeners feel that they don't quite, they haven't heard that, but everyone, they know growth is important. They know we want to get it. They know it's not happening, but they don't know the how.
In broad terms, first is a fairly obvious one. You kind of want to keep the sort of broader macroeconomy stable, by which I mean trying to have reasonably stable inflation and a stable exchange rate. But then the main drivers, I would say, and what I would be seeking to prioritize are probably in descending order. First, skills, absolutely fundamental. I always say that if the day after the referendum in 2016, the government had said, we are going to prioritise skills over everything else, and Mrs May had had a meeting in Downing Street every week with all the key stakeholders in promoting skills, I think by now, 8 years on, you might just be beginning to see a difference, because this is, it's not about the top 20% who go to universities, or actually 30%. It's more about the sort of part of the population which is in the middle, who don't necessarily go to university. But if you gave them the vocational skills to perform better in work, that would make a difference. So skills, I just think the government's got to really focus on this. And as I say, it's boring. You know, you don't get sort of the reception of a clever announcement. But if you don't do it and you've got a 10-year plan, you're not going to change the economy's fundamental performance. Secondly, public investment, really important. Infrastructure, having a coherent infrastructure plan, which is joined up, which doesn't focus on prestige projects like HS2, but focusing relentlessly on the economic and social return of investment projects. Next, I'd say innovation, which is the one area where there has been cross-party support, and it's been one of the success stories of Britain. You saw that during coronavirus with the vaccines and so on. We have a very good record on innovation in biotechnology, advanced engineering, and so on. So that's important. We need to stick at it. We need to keep putting money into science. Next is very underestimated competition. Actually, if you look at a lot of the analysis of why productivity rose in the 90s and early 2000s, it was to do with more a more intensely competitive environment. A lot of that was to do with the single market, which forced British firms to become more efficient and more productive. Sadly, we're not going to rejoin the single market. But
you never know. Who can always hope?
It's a long game. And actually, related to that, we do need to reduce trade barriers where we can. But I don't think the government will be ready to rejoin the single market at this stage. And finally, a broadly supportive tax system, by which I mean just not doing anything silly in relation to business taxes and perhaps having the odd tax break for providing equity to small companies and so on. But if you combine all those things together and you have a coherent plan and you don't just rip it up after a year because you're bored, there's leadership from the Prime Minister, support from the Treasury, but also involving the other key economic departments of state, like what used to be called trade and industry, work and pensions, because getting people back into work, especially off sickness benefit and so on, is going to be really important. You would begin to make a difference.
Going back to this sort of question of how Labour manage the sort of economic situation and sort of let's assume that your sort of optimism doesn't quite play out and it is more or less as the OBR say it's going to be over the next couple of years, which is sort of there is growth, but it's not huge growth. They're going to face a spending review straight off the bat. More or less, that we don't have any plans for public spending that go beyond March of next year. Can you talk us through a bit how the spending review actually works from a Treasury perspective? What are you doing? What are you trying to achieve? How long does it take? Do you think they have time to do it in the space that they've got properly?
Well, it depends when the election is, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, let's assume it's sort of October or November.
They're going to have to make an announcement, I think certainly in my day, by early December, just to give local authorities certainty about the coming year. So my guess is that there will be a fairly quick and dirty emergency budget, which will effectively introduce any exciting tax plans Labour have, which they haven't told us about. It will allocate some of the revenue they raise to the most important symbolic priorities. but largely will roll forward the existing plans for 25, 26. There will then be a more intensive spending review, which I suppose could announce as early as July 25, or might form part of the budget in November 25, which would then set out the full plan for the Parliament and potentially beyond. That would be what the Treasury would be advising. Now, they may want to speed that process up, but I think there does need to be some quite serious discussions about some of the pressures on government. I mean, I haven't even mentioned national security so far. There's increasing view, I think, across Europe, but really across both main parties, that we're going to have to spend more on defence. And yet, the current government, one of the things which surprised me about the budget was how silent it was about defence.
And you've got a lot of Tory MPs who are very unhappy about that, vocally very unhappy about
that. Actually, I think there'll be quite a lot of Labour MPs who will just be getting a bit worried because, look, we've given a lot of kit to Ukraine, but I'm not sure we've backfilled all those weapons. You know, the threat is bigger. And this is going to be a problem for a Labour government. But I think they've got to grasp the nettle. Potentially spending more on defence actually could be good for the northern economy because, you know, the Northwest provides quite a lot of the defence kit. That is going to be a pressure. But then you've got all the areas which we're familiar with, like health and
local government,
education, local government. There'll be wage pressures. I think they're going to have to bear down on wages, which is going to be tricky.
Even more so for a Labour government with the unions.
Yeah, and one of the risks I fear is that because there isn't any money, they will increasingly rely on regulation. There are lots of good things you can do with regulation, but there are also things which actually in the end could be a brake on the economy. I mean, for example, raising the minimum wage by a massive amount actually could begin to cause problems. I mean, this is a work security agenda. Nothing wrong with that, actually. It may well be what's needed for the modern economy, but they've got to move carefully.
And just picking up on your point, Nick, about defence and, I suppose, geopolitics, I mean, a big part of the offer from Rachel Reeves is this concept of this portmanteau of securenomics, which is talking about sort of stability and calming everything down. And that's really important, as you've already said. And I think most people would buy into that and definitely want that. But what about, despite good governance and calm at the heart of government, what about a future Labour government being at the mercy of geopolitics and international events and more conflict? Do we have resilience in our economy to deal with that if there's another flare-up or something like that?
Yes, no. Actually, the British economy has had to deal with extraordinary events over the last 16 years or so, the financial crisis, Brexit, Ukraine, the coronavirus. And actually, yes, we can all get really depressed about where the economy is. But in a funny sort of way, we should celebrate the extraordinary resilience. You know, unemployment is at a low level. Okay, living standards haven't gone up, but actually, you know, Britain has carried on. So look, if there is another crisis, and believe me, there will be many crises, inevitably, there always are. The key thing there is to be able to multitask. I think so long as they can remain focused on the long-term growth agenda whilst also dealing with all the crap which will be thrown at them, because that's just life. You become prime minister and from day one, sort of 101 things are thrown at you which are outside your control. That is the challenge. I think the economy can cope with it, but there are fundamental challenges to do with the fact that we've got an ageing population, the demographic time bomb, which we all worried about back in the 1980s, has, if not exploded, it certainly arrived. You would expect an economy which has more old people in it who are not working and demands things like the triple lock for their basic state pension. You're going to have higher taxes. That's just a fact of life. I mean, that's why the current government's tax burden is rising. It's not because they sort of kind of set out to raise tax burden. It's just the pressures upwards are relentless. You know, it's the age-old challenge Britain's got, which is, you know, can you have a European welfare state with American tax rates? You can't. And something's going to happen.
You end up with an American welfare state with European tax rates if you're not careful.
Exactly.
So, Nick, we're now going to fire some quick fire questions at you. So get ready with machine-like retorts, please. Now, who is the one person, and it can be a silly person, it can be a dead person, it can be someone who's alive, it can be fictional, it can be your favourite superhero. Who would you like to draft into Keir Starmer's first cabinet and in what role?
I'd go for Dennis Healy. I know it's not very creative, but he was very tough, had an amazingly broad intellect. He was Defence Secretary, Chancellor of the Exchequer. So I would have him as Deputy Prime Minister to provide wise, tough advice for difficult times.
Excellent choice.
Yes, I think we could all agree. Fought in the war to quite a...
He was a Beachmaster at Anzio. I only met him once. He once came to lunch with Alistair Darling and he sang lots of songs from the war.
Okay, so what's the one issue you think isn't getting as much coverage in the media or attention from Labour or anyone else as it should have?
Skills. I'm sorry to be boring, but this country is not going to get a rise in living standards unless our working population becomes more skilled. And a lot of this is to do with things like further education, which politicians find boring because they didn't really experience further education. They generally went to Oxbridge or Edinburgh or somewhere. And if you don't tackle the issue of skills in this country, we will continue to underperform.
Every government says that it's important to them, and then they never actually... Yeah, it's actually the budget for it versus schools has sunk by 25%.
Yes, over. They claim to have a skills strategy. It doesn't add up, and it requires spending money.
Yeah.
It requires prioritisation, and it's just never prioritised.
I remember a couple of years ago, I hosted this brilliant all-day conference all about skills, and what was so interesting is that you're so right, Nick. Politicians spend a lot of time talking about schools and universities, but colleges are so, so, so important. Colleges are really the place where so much can happen. And they are such a sort of Cinderella kind of part of the sort of education land. They're not given even the sort of respect of visits and attention and time. And I was really struck by that, actually.
Look, we relied on the Polish taxpayer for far too long to train our workforce. And we can't do that any longer.
Okay. And final question to you, Nick, what's the one test you'd set Labour to demonstrate that they're really ready to change Britain for the better?
My test would be, can they multitask? Can Keir Starmer multitask? Because being in government is really quite hard. You just have to deal with so much, most of which is completely unexpected, and much of it is really quite tedious. They've got to do that whilst also sticking to the plan. If they junk the plan because they can't multitask, they will end up achieving nothing.
Yeah. And how do you sort of sort what's actually important from the trivial stuff that tends to occupy so much of politicians' time these days?
You just look at what's happened in recent years, you know, the problems with members of the government and so on. You have to hope.
You've got to have hope.
You've got to have hope. But then it's the hope that kills you sometimes. It's the
it
hope
is,
that
but, you know, you've got to hope that this time it's different. The worst words you can use.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. And if you are not a member of the Power Test crew, you can head to thepowertest.co.uk or thepowertest.substack.com. You'll get episodes ad-free and early before anyone else. And there's also an exclusive chance to be part of the podcast and lots more. Also, do get involved with us. If you've got any questions or comments or like ideas you'd like us to explore, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us on pod@thepowertest.co.uk. You can also get involved on social media as well.
And we've also got our brand new YouTube channel, which is a Power Test Pod, and you can find clips on there. The Power Test only exists because of the amazing support from you, our members, and our supporters. And we're also delighted to have the backing of some brilliant organisations like the Future Governance Forum, which is providing intellectual and practical infrastructure vital to the revival of progressive government in the UK, and the Centre for Progressive Policy, a think tank championing inclusive economic growth. We're also really glad to have support from the Institute for Global Change, who provide us with exceptional research and briefings, and also partner with the fantastic Labour List, bringing to life many of the issues, themes and discussions we're covering on the pod.
Hold up. Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.